The following program is brought to you by Podcast One. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Now here's your host, John Horn.
Hey everybody, it's John Horn, and today on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, we sit down with Paul Sparks. He has a new miniseries about the Branch Davidians called Waco. You may know him from House of Cards, where he met an unusual death, having sex with Robin Wright. I guess there's worse ways to go. Stick around, Paul Sparks on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Hey guys, it's Kelsey Knight from the Lady Gang Podcast. Happy New Year. How are those resolutions holding up? Our resolution to be awesome is going strong, and it's especially evident in our episode this week, which is our live Lady Hang show. So head on over to iTunes or subscribe to us at Podcast One on the Podcast One app. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Also, thanks for all your support and Happy New Year from the Lady Gang.
Paul Sparks, welcome to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Wow, it's good to be here.
Now, for people who do not know, and I think we should describe this, you are in the midst of what is called the TCAs, which sounds like some sort of ailment that football players get. Mm-hmm. The TCAs are the Television Critics Association meetings, and they go on twice a year, and it's basically, what, 100 television journalist critics who are locked into a hotel for 2 weeks.
Yep.
Doing nothing but watching television and asking actors, showrunners, studio executives all manner of questions until time, as we know it, stops. Do I have that right?
I think that's exactly how it was described to me, and it was exactly what I experienced today.
So how does one prepare for something like that? Because I imagine at a certain point it becomes numbing, but you have to remain interesting and interested.
You know, I've been lucky because I've sort of managed to avoid doing it in the past because, you know, it's taxing. But this particular project, these particular people that are here, it's the Waco show is sort of littered with really lovely people. And so sitting around in a room and joking at the expense of, you know, the AP or whoever it was that was doing it, you know, it's like, it's a good time. It's all right.
Good time talking about
it. It's also like 10
children
degrees
who
in New
died
York.
In a fire, so yeah. It's okay. Yes. And your friend Michael Shannon's in the cast too, right?
He is.
When you are thinking about what it is that's going to tip the scales on a project like this, and for people who don't know, Steve Schneider was David Koresh's aide-de-camp, chief lieutenant. How would you describe Schneider?
That's right. Number one.
You know, not what you would call a romantic hero. Interesting backstory, but complicated guy. How do you figure out a way in a part like that? Because he's a true person, lived a real life.
Correct.
And yet he was involved in some horrible doing. So what's your path in for somebody who is real but not typically likable?
Well, I play a lot of people that are not always particularly likable, and I think that, I mean, the number one thing I look for whenever I read a script, because that's where I start. I start with the script, because it doesn't even matter that it's based on a true story as much as I might like that story. If the writing, the way the characters are sort of portrayed within the script, then I, like, that's where it all is for me. And the Dowdle brothers, Drew and John, they wrote really sort of nuanced person. You kind of had to deal with the, I guess, the hard parts of this part, which was kind of the misunderstanding or the way they're perceived. You know, I'm from Oklahoma. I remember this well. I remember this sort of narrative that was pushed out. That was, oh, there's some crazy people and they're somewhat sexually deviant and who knows what's going, and they've got lots of guns, and what are we going to do with those people? But, you know, this is the logical outcome. But as we really delved into it. I got really lucky. They had a lot of resource. I talked to Steve Schneider's sister, who's Sue, who's still around. She sort of painted a picture. We also had the luxury of – it was based on two books. It's based on Gary Nesner, who was the head negotiator of the FBI. He wrote about it. Also, David Thibodeau.
Who survived, who escaped, right?
The nine survivors. And they were both on set. And Thibodeau was on set almost the whole time. And these two people don't necessarily agree about the sort of who did it or who started it or whose fault it was. However, they were both – just like the Dowdles, there was this sort of like open communication of like the most important part of this are the people that are sort of caught in the middle of this impossible situation. And what we found and what I found is that, you know – yeah, they make some terrible decisions, but, you know, it doesn't make them any less human.
No, I think that's very interesting because I think not only is Waco coming out, there's a new miniseries about the Rajneeshi and they're moving to Oregon, right. About Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And it is very much, like Waco, a story about the people who were drawn into that community.
Right.
And yes, it ended badly. And I think we can agree that certainly ended much worse for the Branch Davidians. But I think a lot of people, including you and me, remember things differently. And the more we look into a story, the more our eyes are open to what we're taught and what isn't actually true.
Right.
And is that the appeal for a show, too, that you yourself are learning something, that it's history that you didn't understand or it's a new take on it?
I think so. I mean, you know, like I said, I'm like really I like writers. I like how they write. When they're good, it's exciting to me. I'm one of those actors that I think if writing is good and it's dense and it has a lot of things in it, I can help. I can be a good helper for that. But if it is bad sort of writing, I'm not very good at filling in and sort of making something out of nothing. That's not my deal. And I'm bad at it. And so that's the original part of it. And I do like the idea of sort of telling this story. I really grew to it, but it wasn't why I started. I now feel that it's important that people see just kind of what was going on there, a little more accurate. Even though it is fictionalized, it's not like we have like transcripts of what was going on in the, you know, behind the scenes, but there are transcripts between the negotiators.
Yeah. And there are even some transcripts of your character talking just randomly, I think with David Koresh, because the FBI during the siege was able to sneak listening devices into the milk crates.
That's right.
That were sent in with the milk that were feeding the children. There's some audio of Steve Schneider.
There is.
And you know, as recorded by a bug in a milk crate.
Yeah. And what's so interesting about it, because so much of this particular story is about, you know, there's like this gulf, this like, there was like this thin line of communication, which was the telephone between, you know, the tanks and the people inside the building. And then there is this big sort of area where nobody could see what was actually going on. And so one of the things I think they do in the telling of this story is what's going on inside, what they're listening to is not always representative of what people are hearing going on. And so that miscommunication just exacerbates, you know, it's like a perfect storm of just a mess.
It's a mess,
the story.
When you are thinking about the collaborators who are most important to you, it strikes me that you have – I mean, I think there are actors who have strong relationships with theater companies. They might be, you know, really involved in Steppenwolf or,
right.
you know, the public. And you seem to have strong relationships with playwrights, that there are a number of playwrights. I would put Adam Rapp on that list,
yep.
Craig Wright, Tracy Letts,
yep.
that you seem to have really strong relationships with. Do you think that's common for actors, or you find yourself really in partnership with playwrights more than other people that you know might be?
I think it's somewhat rare. I don't know that everybody – that's a normal sort of tack. I think some people probably have relationships with directors that they use a lot or work with a lot. You know, of that group, Adam was sort of the beginning for me. And, you know, I feel like we were sort of both out there in the wilderness, like what does one do in order to be seen and to – But I always felt like I was the kind of Steve Schneider of that situation. You know, I always felt like I was sort of the number two. I thought that the writing was more important. It was really interesting. Maybe that level of like supplication has endeared me in some ways to writers, you know, that because I believe it. You know, I really do. I think that their job, I think that a good play is better than a good actor.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think playwrights and theatrical directors recognize that. I think the movie business is different, unfortunately.
I think
that as a career choice or just as a life choice, being aligned with people who are writing good words is probably a very smart idea. So was Adam one of the first people you started working with when you came to New York?
Well, I mean, no. You know, I'd sort of worked with – there was actually a guy, this guy, Steven Spoonamore, that I first – who was like – he's disappeared from the business. I worked with him a little bit when I first out of school. But, you know, I was mostly working with friends, and we were just trying to figure out – I was just doing theater for nothing. And slowly, I started to kind of have a presence in New York. And Adam was a person I met, like, out – at a regional theater. I was doing a show at the Contemporary American Theater Festival, which is in West Virginia, in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And he was there. I think he had a girlfriend who was there at the time. And he was this sort of, I don't know if you've ever met Adam, but he's just like tall. He's like 6'4". He plays basketball. He's kind of this big, goofy looking guy. And he had said to me, he was like, "Hey, man, he's like, I wrote this play, and Dallas Roberts is another actor, was down there. He said, Dallas is going to read it if you want to come." And I was like, "Oh, I'm sure you've written a play." And it was this play, Nocturne. And it was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. And I literally said to him afterwards, I was like, "Listen, man, I'll tear tickets. You know, I think what you're doing is really, really important." And I do become a cheerleader for them. I feel that way about Craig. There's an aspect of what they're after and how they're doing it that I just am really attracted to, and I like it.
And you're also describing something that I think so many actors miss out on, and they probably are glad at the time that they're missing out on it, and that is working tiny parts in regional theater, mm-hmm. making those small connections that are going to be important later in life, knowing what it's like to struggle or to have a small part in a terrible production, and doing it like not even one step at a time, but like half a step at a time.
That's right.
And earning your career as opposed to, you know, landing and getting cast in some big show and like, yeah, that was easy.
Right.
I think people who struggle a little bit tend to have a much better, healthier perspective on their career than people who don't.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I you know, there's so many stories of how people end up making it or being successful or what they consider to be successful or what they don't consider to be successful in this business. I know for me, it was a really great way to do it, especially in retrospect, I can say that, because I did feel like I had earned the right to sort of be here, and that for me was that's a big part of being – not to be too actorly, but, you know, being comfortable when I'm working on a scene, you know, just like going in and working with now with cameras or whatever it is, you know, a lot of it is just feeling like, okay, I can do this. I deserve to be here. People want me here. That's a big part of the sort of relaxing process for me, because it's like not a very relaxed environment.
But what you're describing is a job as opposed to a gig. That this is what you do. This is your work.
That's right.
We talk to a lot of people who come to the show about people who were important early in their career or before they were even acting. I want to ask you about Paula McConnell.
Oh, my gosh.
And what she meant to you and where she entered your life and how important her advice and counsel was to you when you were a young man.
You know, my father – I'll start with my dad. My dad was a teacher as well. My mother was a teacher. And Paula McConnell was my high school drama teacher. And he never made me take any class ever, never except one. He said, "You're going to have to take a speech class." He said, "I'm going to make you take a speech class," which I did not want to take. And he said, "Because, you know, when I was in college, I didn't know how to speak in front of people. And it really, I think it made me a better person when I finally did it and I learned." And he said, "So I think you should take this class." So I take the speech class, and it's run by Paula McConnell, who is this you know, she was just kind of this crazy theater lady, you know, in Oklahoma.
I think most theater teachers in high school are crazy ladies.
Who was kind of out there on a limb by herself, you know, in a very conservative rural community in Oklahoma. And she was very she kind of handled me with kid gloves initially. You know, I was a football player, and I was it was not necessarily like where the cool kids were was in the theater. But she was sort of enticed me into, you should try out for the play, and you should try out for this, and you should try out for that, and you should do. And I got into like forensics, you know, like competitive speech, yeah, which, you know, we just became masters of. We just destroyed people in that. We were she was legendary in Oklahoma in that capacity.
And this is where you're doing crazy arguments like why Hitler was good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we did more of the acting stuff. I kind of left the debate stuff there, but it was ridiculous. All of it was ridiculous. However, when I was graduating from high school, and her husband Gary, who's no longer alive, he was around.
This is Paula McConnell's husband.
Paula McConnell's husband Gary. He was also very much involved with like the theater there in Marlow. He and she especially said, you know, because I was thinking of going to Oklahoma State and I was going to study chemistry, chemical engineering there. And she said, you know, they have a theater program up there. And I said, yeah, okay. And she said, you know, I think they might have a scholarship or something. You know, you could get a day out of school. You could go up there and just like audition. It'd just be some free money. You know, you just take like, even if you got it, you know, you just take like some general education classes, you still do your thing, you know. Well, of course, I'm sure not that many people auditioned for the Oklahoma State Theater Scholarship, and I did get it. And then I realized once I got it, you know, that not only did I have to take an acting class, but, you know, I also had to audition for the play, which, of course, I had a pulse, and so I got in. You know, the rest kind of was history, but she was the one. She was the one. She was like, I want to take you to New York, like, for your senior trip. You guys should come and, like, see what New York is like. Like, she's always been that.
Did you do that? Did you go to New York with her? Do you remember what you saw, what plays you saw?
I feel like we saw, like, Phantom of the Opera and maybe what was that play? We saw City of Angels, maybe. City of Angels? Is that a play?
Yeah.
A musical?
I feel like they're all. Who knows? It is now. But the other thing that she did and people like her do is she took you outside of your circumference of knowledge and exposure. She took you from a small town into the larger world.
That's right.
She introduced you to stories and storytellers and ways of accessing art that maybe you hadn't been exposed to. So it wasn't just that she believed in you as an actor. She said there's another world out there that you hadn't seen.
Right. And then I had that same experience when I went to college at Oklahoma State. There was a woman named Tracy Callahan who was this kind of crazy woman from Chicago who had a totally different way of looking at theater. You know, she was a very Steppenwolf sort of kind of person, and she taught us about, I don't know, just the sort of the how to look at a script, how to break down a script, you know. And and it didn't take me very long to realize that I was going to be a really average chemist. And I sure liked it a lot better over in the theater department at Oklahoma State. So, yeah.
How do you, when you are given that gift, it got me thinking, just listening to you, that early in my career, I got to be an intern at the LA Times. And the reason I got to be an intern is somebody said, why don't you come hang out with me, an editor, and spend a couple of days with me? And whenever somebody to this day says, I'm interested in radio or journalism, can I come hang with you? I say, absolutely, because somebody did that for me when I was young. How do you make sure that you or collectively that kind of looking after people gets paid back, as opposed to what we hear from so many other actors, like, don't do it, it's horrible, you know, it's too competitive, it's misery, don't try it? How do you carry what Paula gave to you directly or indirectly into other people's lives?
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I have kids, and I mean, I don't talk about my kids too much, but I will say this about them. You know, people ask me, would you let your kids like to be in this business? And look, I'm aware of like what a hard business it is. And, you know, it makes me reticent of sometimes the idea of seeing your kids like doing like professional stuff, which I probably wouldn't do, or I know I wouldn't do. However, I've always said, how could I possibly say anything that isn't positive about a business that I love? I love doing this. I love being an actor. I feel so fortunate. And so whenever anybody says to me that that's what they're up that's up for them, I tell them, I'm like, look, it is hard. There's no, I don't know the way to do it. My usual advice is stay persistent. Don't stop. You know, just kind of stay persistent. Just keep working and stay persistent. But yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm not good at networking people into my world, but I do think that like being in this business, you know, it's such a gift for me. So
what do you like about it? You say you love it. What are the satisfactions that you find the most rewarding?
I love solving puzzles. I love turning on this sort of empathy of my own humanity, where I really try to absorb like what other people are going through, try and suss out who the people are that writers are talking about, try and figure out like what that is and sort of examine that in myself, be surprised by who it pulls out of me. You know, there's a lot of things we don't get to do in this life. You know, there's a lot. I'm actually a reasonably shy person. I've never been a, you know, super outgoing or extroverted person, but I can be all those things that I don't get to be as an actor. But mostly I love the problem solving. I love it. I love that somebody writes a really dense piece of work that they know the answers to. They've seen it in their head, because you can feel a text when it has that, when there's a lot to like the characters, but trying to like figure out and sort of give it your own spin. I mean, to me, I can just do that all day. That's why I love the theater.
Do you think there's a different challenge or satisfaction to playing some of the kinds of characters that you've typically played? Addicts, misfits, philanderers, creeps. Is there something different about playing what we will call the anti-hero or the villain of a story that you enjoy more? And do those parts tend to feed on one another? Are you drawn to them? Do you tend to get offered more of those parts? That was a multi-part question.
It was. I don't know. You know, people sort of say that to me. I play a lot of creeps. And I guess that's true. I sort of enjoy the noble creep. You know, I like to think of people as misunderstood. I like the sort of subversive nature of taking hold of a role that people have sort of discounted them and said, well, I know exactly who they are. And being able to really like dig into who they are and find that there's actually a lot more there than you think, like that gives me great pleasure to do. And I think that most well-written creeps offer that. I don't know. I mean, is that what we write about? It's a lot more creeps than there are in our generation of like stuff that's coming out. Is there a lot?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, it's the old, I mean, I've been a journalist my whole life. You know, the school bus that shows up on time is not a story. The school bus that doesn't is news. So
that's right.
People behaving well and getting along isn't newsworthy.
Yeah,
people
killing
others or doing horrible things is.
I mean, I think that there's an aspect of it that's that, you know. And I think that a lot of times stories are sort of populated by some of the people who are kind of like nonplussed because there's somebody acting badly in it, that we need those two different people. And I end up being the person that's causing problems a lot of the time. But I don't know. Yeah, those parts are – I'm not going to lie to you too. You know, those parts are fun. You know, a lot of times they're more peacock roles. You know, they do things that are crazy, and that's just fun to do. You know, it's fun to see if you can make that work.
I want
to
ask you about a couple of things you've done in New York. Coyote on a Fence, what that play and that part meant to you, where it came in your career, and why it was important.
Right. Well, the summer that I met Adam Rapp, I was doing Coyote on a Fence at Contemporary American Theater Festival, a beautiful play written by Bruce Graham, who somehow is from Philadelphia, even though that play is so like in my bones from Texas and Oklahoma. And I did it with a guy named Lee Sellers, who's an amazing actor. And, you know, it was like the first time I ever got cast in New York, really, at a casting audition. Like, nobody knew me. They just cast me. And when I went down to play that part down there, it was great. It went over well, as things do sometimes in regional theater. And then when I had a chance to move to New York, I got lucky, and I guess they couldn't find anybody famous, so they cast me, which I still to this day think is funny, because I think there was a little bit of that going on.
Woody Harrelson's unavailable.
Right, but it was like, you know, to make $206, you know, at the Blue Heron Theater on 24th Street, and, you know, between Park Avenue and Lex. It's just like, that's not a well-trafficked area for doing theater. However, somebody, I think it was somebody from like the Village Voice or something, saw that show and wrote just a love letter to it and to me. And, you know, I'd sort of existed in this group of people. We knew each other, but nobody knew us. And somehow the kind of awards people, like the Drama Desk people, found me. And I got nominated for a Drama Desk. And literally no one knew who I was. And it was like me and Derek Jacobi and Phil Hoffman and Gabriel Byrne. I mean, it was ridiculous. I'll tell you this. Cameron Manheim doesn't know this story, but she was in Waco with me. And I meant to bring it up, but I didn't bring it up because I just didn't have the courage. But she did the award for that. And I had been told at the Drama Desk, I was like, you know, there's no chance you can win. I mean, nobody's seen this.
There was like nine people in the audience. Don't even worry about writing a speech. You don't need to show up. Okay.
So when the award came, my heart started beating, even though I knew I couldn't possibly win. So she's going down the list of all the people, all these, she's like, oh, this category is just, there's such these great men on this, such great men. And I've kissed most of them. She's like, I've like had intimate, she had just done Happiness. She's talked about it. She's like, just done Happiness with Phil Hoffman, and oh, what a great kisser he is. And Gabriel Byrne is the most beautiful man. Stephen Delane, blah, blah, and Derek Jacobi, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what is she going to say?
When she gets
about,
to you.
What is she going to say about me? Because I was the last name. And literally, with a question mark at the end, said, and Paul Sparks? And like one guy in the theater was like, woo, with a question mark. Like, is this a mistake? No. I like to talk about people on the radio.
But that is a great example of the award. The nomination is the award.
That's right.
Yep. I'm going to ask you about another play, Dusk Rings a Bell.
Stephen Bilmer, another great playwright. I love Stephen, and I've known him a long time, and I've done a lot of readings on plays, and we never could get it together. And Kate Walsh was in that, and she was so good. And it was this really beautiful play. I remember saying to my wife, Annie Priest, who's also an actress, I said, you know, I'm not sure if this play is actually – it's so gentle. It's so gentle that I'm – it might not be about anything. Like I almost can't tell, but I'm so riveted by it. And that was at the beginning of Sam Gold's sort of like career. I mean, he directed that, and he just came in and just directed the shit out of it.
And by the way, we should pause here and say, for people who do not know who Sam Gold is, I can't imagine a better director in the theater right now.
He's pretty good.
I saw his Othello with David Oyelowo and Daniel Craig. He directed Glass Menagerie.
He is a super.
He did Doll's House Part Two, I believe. Lucas Nasbeck.
He does everything.
Anyway, you were talking about this.
Yeah. So we went into it. You know, it's funny because I remember the New York Times did an article about me when I was doing that. And there were some awards and things that I got nominated for. And so they did an award. Now, the New York Times has had a kind of a tricky relationship with me and Adam Rapp for a long time up until that point. You know, they'd sort of – there was – I mean, I don't know how much you know of this story of what was the guy's name? Who was the sort of the second string?
Charles Isherwood.
Yeah, Isherwood. So Isherwood despises Adam. He like wrote an article in the New York Times about how much I can't stand him. And, you know, I'd done a lot of his plays. And trust me, he did not hold back in some of the things that he said about us. And so I felt at that time when I was like, look, is this a setup? Are you guys bringing me in here but no, it wasn't. It was lovely. It was a lovely show. It was like, that was a surprise. That was a surprise in my life, that one. I loved that show.
Let me ask you this last question about surprises. When you are on a series, and I'm thinking of House of Cards, and your character is finally going to be written off the show.
Yeah.
Do you know months in advance, weeks in advance, a day in advance that your character is no longer part of the future? And is that something, when that comes around, how are you told? How is it explained? Mm-hmm. And then how silent do you have to be about what's going to happen so people aren't surprised once it actually happens?
That's a good question. You know, it depends. Like the people at Boardwalk are a little different. You know, Terry would give you the phone call, let you know when it was all happening. Whenever Terry called, please be afraid.
Do not answer the phone,
you know,
when Terrence Winters is calling.
Yeah, the funny thing about that was is that we'd been all thinking we were going to be killed off on that show for so many years that by the time he actually called me, there was a little
finally.
There was like some relief. On House of Cards, I knew somewhat in advance. I mean, I smelled it. I could tell there was I got a vibe from what was going on that like this might be where they were going. I don't know. It was a little bit of a different situation. You know, my final season on that, Bo Willimon had been writing the show and Bo left. And when he left, you know, it changed. You know, it had to change. The character changed a little bit, especially because I think in many ways that, you know, not that it was autobiographical, but I think he really like that was his character. You
sure.
Know? So when Frank and Melissa took over, I think that there was some it changed. It changed who the part was. And I think they were trying to figure out a way in which that worked. And I think, you know, you are subordinate to the sort of higher ups and what was going on with Robin's character and what they want to do with that. But, you know, they were very kind. I don't remember exactly when they told me, but I knew a few weeks before, probably.
And they tell you that, I mean, I think most actors would agree on film and on stage, two of the hardest things to do are die mm-hmm. and have sex. And that you're going to do the two things in the same scene with the character, Robin, who is directing your performance, correct?
That's right.
The trifecta or whatever that is.
I was
going
to say, if I'd had to laugh, what else? Play pool and take care of a dog and a baby at the same time. It would have been the worst. No, it is hard. They're horrible. Both those things are horrible to do. They're so
to die and to have sex on
so hard. And it's I find it especially hard. I think some people can do that kind of. To me, it always feels really fakey because you're not going to die and you're not having sex. Well, I don't know. Some people might be.
Unless you're James Franco. I didn't say that. Sorry.
Oh my gosh. Lord have mercy. I don't know how anybody could do that anyway. So there's a whole profession of it. I find it to be really difficult. It's like a very difficult thing to like pretend you are having sex, to pretend that you are expiring. And so, yeah, that was hard.
Finally, you are doing a play. Tell us a little bit about it and when it opens.
I'm doing a play at the Signature Theater in New York. We're doing an Edward Albee play at Home at the Zoo. It's sort of a unique one of his plays because he wrote it. He wrote The Zoo Story back in 1959, and then he wrote Home Life, which is sort of the precursor to the Zeus story in 2007 or 8 or something like that. And now it's – I mean, after his death, it is – this is the only way you can do it. And they're great plays, and I'm doing it with Robert Sean Leonard, Katie Finneran, who are both geniuses. Lila Neugebauer is directing it. She's like on the Sam Gold track to be greatest of all time. She's a good deal.
And previews start when?
I think they start the 30th of January, and then maybe it opens around the 18th of February, you know, and it'll run through.
And Waco is on Paramount Network on January 24th, right?
24.
Mm-hmm. Good times. Paul Sparks, thank you so much for coming on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
That was Paul Sparks on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. If you like what you heard, you can check out past episodes. And while you're enjoying more from Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or at podcastone.com. And as always, remember to rate, review, and share.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every Wednesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at Apple Podcasts.